The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard-issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com. Knives, machetes, saws, and shears, multi-tools, shovels, swords, axes, spears, hatchets, and tomahawks. If it cuts, snips, slices, or chops, Midway USA has it. Find great gift ideas in our huge selection of pocket knives and other everyday carry folding knives. Make a statement or create a family legacy with one of our top-of-the-line hunting knives. We've got a great selection of manual and electric sharpeners, too. For just about everything for the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com. Midway USA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high-quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping. MidwayUSA.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Maine Operation Game Thief, New Hampshire Wildlife Heritage Foundation, and International Wildlife Crime Stoppers. This podcast is brought to you in part by Sovereign Sportsman Solutions. As conservation officers, we know just how important technology is in this day and age. S3 is a cutting-edge and trusted vendor that provides state agencies with licensing, mobile, CRM, marketing, law enforcement, and event management solutions all in one place. They are dedicated to benefiting the resource, so check out the link in the show notes to sign up for their newsletter and get the industry insights, news, and content that can keep you up to date on the tech that helps drive conservation into the future. A Game Warden's children's book, titled A Cowboy in the Woods, is a story of Bobby, a boy who spends the whole summer observing wildlife, writing notes in his notebook, fishing with his dad, and keeping track of all the animals in his neighborhood. While trying to solve a neighborhood mystery, what he discovers is more than just an appreciation for the natural world. The idea for this book came from Wayne Saunders' own childhood experiences, growing up and exploring the woods and streams and lakes and ponds of his native New Hampshire. The love of nature instilled in his childhood led him to a career as a conservation officer. Wayne Saunders is a retired lieutenant conservation officer from the New Hampshire Fish and Game Department. Lindsay Webb is a naturalist, wildlife biologist, and environmental educator. Together, they collaborated with wildlife artist Ashley Mayers to produce The Cowboy in the Woods, the story of a boy whose love of nature leads him in unexpected directions. Available at wardenswatch.com and Amazon. Listen to the Thin Green Line podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Game Wardens John Norris and Wayne Saunders talk about wildlife, the outdoors, law enforcement, environmental subjects mixed with current events and guests that are part of the Thin Green Line. And if you are one of those visual people, like me, for $5 a month, you can see the actual podcast on Patreon.com. Just search the Thin Green Line podcast on Patreon.com and join us.
We love our children. We protect them. We guide them. We prepare them for life in the world. With all that we do, from deep in our hearts, we cannot control all things. Life-threatening illnesses and disabilities affect far too many of our children each year. While we cannot change the circumstance, we can make dreams come true. Dreams to provide hope, to provide spiritual healing and strength, to provide moments of happiness and relief in the hardest of times. We can give a glimmer of light and hope in a time of darkness and despair. Join huntofalifetime.org to help make dreams come true, to provide hope for children with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Hunt of a Lifetime is a nonprofit organization fulfilling dreams for hunting and fishing trips to youth 21 and under with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Visit huntofalifetime.org to learn how you can make a difference.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders,
and other game wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experience of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch. Warden's Watch, Episode 63, Part 2, Operation Cody, Todd Vandervoort. You guys heard Part 1, and this is such a detailed, descriptive interview about Operation Cody. We had to go into Part 2, which I'm so happy that we can do a Part 2 on an undercover operation, John, because it really does go in depth, and it tells you how bad it is. This operation only ran for a year. Had it run a little longer, and Todd talks about some bumps in the roads he had, but at least he tells those kind of bumps in the roads. So, you know, I wouldn't judge everything. He exposes a lot of different things. When we have decisions that are made, sometimes we don't agree with them. But in this case, it was still a very, very successful operation. He wraps it all together really good. So this is Part 2.
Yeah, this is great. And you know what? This goes to show you that these in-depth poaching operations take so much work that we had to discuss the details very deep and to go into a Part 2. Mm. Just like when we talked about Operation Bear Conduit, you know, the bear case I had back in California. Yes. That went like a year and a half. I mean, I noticed when we started to tell that story and share it and I started to relive it, I'm like, man, there's a lot of moving parts to this little puzzle. This is a big puzzle. This is a 5,000 piece puzzle, not a 200 piece, you know, and Operation Cody is one of those. And so I'm glad we got to go in depth, and I'm glad we got to go deeper so we could tell the whole story with this second part. And you guys are going to love it, and we're going to have more of it.
Yeah. And it's amazing how deep Todd was able to get with Operation Cody. So enjoy the conclusion, Part 2, Todd Vandervoort, Operation Cody.
We did get some really hardcore individuals. We got some people in the Yakima area that were the first transaction we did from them was to buy a bighorn sheep. And then we subsequently bought deer and elk from them, eagle feathers, hawk feathers. They're really into raptors. They made, although neither one of the people, there was only two at first, then it expanded. Couple more people joined their group. Nobody in the group was Native American, but they specialize in making Native American type of accessories. They did, you know, dream catchers and smudge fans and, you know, all kinds of different Native American regalia. And they did it with bear parts, real bear parts, real eagle parts, and that kind of thing. And then they would sell them to anybody. I mean, they in that particular case, they were not being sold to Native Americans. They were being sold to everybody but Native Americans. So we did a lot of business with them. They sold us basically everything. I mean, it was one-stop shopping with them. If we had rhino, they would have sold us rhino. You know, I mean, they were into everything. Hardcore meth addicts, all of them, that whole group. So, I mean, the Operation Cody was extremely effective. By the end of the operation, we came up with over 100 suspects who had committed. Most of the crimes were felony. They were the federal felony or state felony. Washington's statute now, and the statute changed partway through our operation, but the statute now says any unlawful trafficking in wildlife is a felony. And so they were serious crimes against about 100 people. And the 100 people were not 100 people in Washington. The individual I talked about that ran the restaurant, Chinese restaurant, he had us, for example, using him as an example, he had us ship bear parts to New York, to Chicago, to Portland, to somewhere in California, I think San Francisco. And each one of those, as you know, by crossing state lines, putting them in transit, constituted a federal offense. And so either federal agents or state officers, or in most cases, both, would take over the case on their end when we did the takedowns on our end. And so as a result, For example, when I ship bear parts to Chicago, the person we ship them to is of interest, and then where they went from there is of interest. And if they can show that Bob bought them and was the receiver of them in Chicago, and then Bob sent them, sold parts to Steve, John, and Fred. Steve, John, and Fred are also eligible for arrest.
Right.
So that's how we got up to 100, and we got well over 1,000 counts of various crimes. Some people had racked up quite a list of crimes. Others we had on 3 or 4. We had to, one of the things that going into this case, that when you have a case that goes for 2 years that you know of, is that if you don't continue doing business with these guys, by the time you get into the search warrant aspect of it, you know, the takedown, if the last time you did business with them was 8 months or 10 months ago, there's not very many judges are going to give you a search warrant on 10-month-old stale information.
Right.
So we at least kept our, you know, one toe in the water with them until the very end, so that we could get fresh information to get search warrants obtained. Because our goal was not to just arrest the people we did business with, but we wanted to arrest the people who provided the people we did business with. For example, I mean, if somebody's selling us elk, we wanted to know where they got the elk from.
Right.
We had an individual that we worked with in Tacoma. He was, I wouldn't call him like a member of an organized crime unit. I think he you could comfortably say he was the head of an organized crime group. He was, I think, Cambodian, and he ran a real large cockfighting business. I got to see cockfighting for the first time in my life.
Wow.
He did a lot of marijuana grow and purchases of marijuana, which now is kind of irrelevant. He was really, really big time into trafficking in deer and elk. As a matter of fact, he was the single largest wildlife trafficker that I've ever heard identified in our state.
Wow.
He would sell dozens and dozens of deer and elk. He got most of the elk from tribal members who he had a connection with, a Yakima tribal member that would drive over and provide him with the elk. So he would order, say, 5 elk. These people would drive over with 5 elk in the back of their truck, unload them in his garage. Then he would call his buyers and say, come and get your elk. He wouldn't sell one at a time because it wasn't worth his time to sell just one at a time. So he preferred sales of 2 or more elk at a time. I didn't think I could fit 5 elk in a truck, but I did it in my pickup one. He was an interesting character. He was the one out of everybody we dealt with. I'll back up a little bit. When I started doing undercover, you know, family members and a lot of people said, God, isn't that super dangerous? You know, I mean, that's got to be really hazardous. You sure you want to do this? And one of the things I realized right off the bat was in my opinion, people might argue with me, but in my opinion, undercover fish and wildlife is safer than being a uniform officer. I say on the surface, that doesn't make much sense. But I explain it to people this way. If you're walking up a river and there's a guy up there fishing, and you're in uniform, you're a uniform officer, and he looks down the river and sees you walking towards him, and he has a felony warrant for attempted murder. You don't know it. He does. And he sees you walking up, sees the portable radio that you've got on your hip, on your gun belt, and all this, and he realizes that he's probably going to end up in jail because he doesn't have a fishing license. And when the officer runs him, they find out he's wanted for attempted murder, and there he goes. Mm-hmm. So the guy has a couple choices. One is to, you know, stand his ground and take it like a man, just, you know, see what happens. Another one is to run, take off, and hopefully you can get away from the officer and not get caught. And the third one is to fight. Use the element of surprise to your advantage. The officer doesn't know you're wanted, doesn't know you're a criminal. So they figure out, okay, I'll wait for the earliest opportunity to attack this officer and get away. The same individual is fishing on the river, and we go up in undercover capacity. I mean, by the time I was done with SIU, I had hair well beyond my shoulders and a full beard. So they see me walking up the river to them, and the same guy that, you know, would run or fight because he's got a felony warrant would offer you a beer and sit there and talk to you forever. So the bad guys, obviously the whole purpose of undercover, one of the things you have to do is gain their trust. You know, if they don't trust you, they're not going to do illegal business with you. So the bad guys in in these cases, in these undercover contact, as long as they don't figure out who you are, you're great. I mean, they consider you at least a trusted business partner, if not a friend.
Right.
And so, you know, you can spend all day with seriously bad guys. And as I said, as long as they don't find out who you are with you when you're with them, you're great. This individual was extremely careful. He interviewed us before he did business with us. He separated us to talk to us individually, see if we both had the same answer. He was by far the most dangerous guy, in my opinion, that we dealt with on the entire operation. He had guys that I don't know that they worked for him essentially, but they were under his control. He had guys that he called his soldiers, and they were the ones that were, you know, right under him. They were the ones that did his trusted dirty work. And then below that, he had people that he called his monkeys. And his monkeys were, they were all Vietnamese or Cambodian. I can't remember which. They were all from the same country. And the monkeys were just laborers. You know, if he, for example, when I went in to buy elk, or when we went in to buy elk, my partner and I, he would have his monkeys load up the back of the truck. He'd say, you know, give them 3 elk and 2 deer and load them up. And, you know, we did an interview with him, which was rather trying. And, you know, we both afterwards thought, I wonder if we'd failed the interview, whether we would have left wrapped up in a tarp.
Right.
So, yeah, we were concerned about him. We had video camera on every transaction we did. We at least had one camera running on every single second of every transaction we did. So we knew no matter what, there's a video record of what was said, what was done. Not what was said, because Washington is a two-party consent state, which means you can't record without their permission. So we couldn't record audio, but we had video of every minute of every transaction. Mm-hmm. And this particular guy, because of his other activities, we also put a remote camera on his place to do full-time surveillance on his place. It recorded 24 hours a day. Wow. And so we'd literally have to manually go back through it and see what had occurred. So we had a ton of information on him, who the other people that he dealt with were, et cetera. And I guess at this point, I'll wrap up that operation by saying we worked it. As I said at the beginning, we were supposed to be allowed to go 2 years. We worked it one hunting season, and then we got into summertime, real early fall, summer, and Officer Marcet and I, at that time, she was acting Detective Marcet. At that time, we were on a case on the east side of the state when we found out that they were having a meeting in the Olympia office about the future of Operation Cody, how long it would be allowed to go, et cetera, et cetera. I thought it was a little telling that they had a meeting with the U.S. Attorney's Office, the feds, and our state guys, and didn't invite the two people that were running, you know, actually run the case. It was then on that day that we learned that they were going to shut it down early. They were going to shut us down on September 18th. And so I was pissed, primarily because for one example, the guy that was supposed to get us a truckload of starter plants and all the grow stuff, we had it all lined up to do. That was going to be after September 18th. And we couldn't get him to speed it up because he was in California at the time.
Right.
So we lost that altogether. And that just went out the window because our agency apparently was dead set on doing it on the 18th. And the U.S. Attorney's Office and DEA, I think, had tried to convince them to continue on until at least we got that case done, but it wasn't to be. So on September 18th, Officer Marstad and I set up all of our case reports, our computers and everything on a conference table in an office, Fish and Wildlife office. And we had split up the cases that we had 50-50. Jennifer had half of the cases. I had the other half of the cases. And we had given our phone numbers, names to the officers that were actually doing the search warrant. We had search warrants going all across the U.S., a lot in Washington. So we told each of the search teams, for this particular case, call Officer Marstad. For this part of it, call me.
Right.
And everything was going great. We had search warrants that were going to be served early in the morning to search warrants that were going to be served later in the evening, based on when we thought the best opportunity to catch them at home would be. We wanted to catch the individuals while they were at home, in some cases so that we could physically arrest them, and in most cases because we wanted to interview them. We had hoped at the beginning of this thing, like I said earlier, not just to get the people that were doing it, but the people who were supplying it. You know, I mean,
right.
For example, the individual that was selling dozens and dozens of elk and deer, we wanted to know where he was getting them and who else was buying from him.
Right.
So on September 18th, we're sitting in our little conference table answering questions from the field. Everything was going really well. People were coming up with good evidence and all that. And then that really good informant I told you about, the guy that I had had as an informant on the Kill 'Em All Boys case, he called me out of the blue. I hadn't heard from him in quite a while. He's a friend of mine now. We get along real well.
Yeah.
He called me and said, do you have anything to do with this big statewide bust that's going on? And I go, what statewide bust? And he goes, oh, it's all over the news. It's on the internet that you guys are hitting all these commercial businesses for wildlife trafficking crimes all across the state of Washington right now. Logged on the computer, got on to, I think it was Como, for one of the local news stations. And right off the bat, here's our deputy chief in uniform explaining what we're doing, that we're doing serving warrants now, you know, and da, da, da. To say that's unprecedented doesn't even say enough.
A little premature.
I mean, I have never, ever in my career, not only have I never heard of it, but I've never talked to anybody that's heard of a time where the administration of a law enforcement agency announces that we're serving search warrants before we've served them, before we've served all of them. And so it was absolutely stunning to me, just blew me away. And so we then started calling everybody that hadn't done a search warrant and telling them that there was a possibility that their target might know that they're coming. So obviously when that's the case, you have to be super careful.
Right. Officer safety is to a different level.
And your chances of finding evidence go down significantly too.
Yes.
That would have to be an idiot to sit on the evidence when they know you're coming.
Right.
You know, like I said, whether that endangered any of our people or not is entirely up to who you ask.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't on the search warrants. I didn't have any part of that other than directing them by phone. But some of the individuals, some of our officers that served search warrants felt that that jeopardized their safety. Some didn't. I think that was largely based on what their opinion of the individuals involved were, the deputy chief or myself. So it is what it is. It happened. It's old news now.
Right.
I wasn't pretty upset. I was livid about it at the time. But there's nothing I could do other than to tell officers to be safe, you know, be extra vigilant when you serve these warrants.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
At the end of the day, the warrants, all of them, all the ones in Washington and all the contacts people made in other jurisdictions all went perfectly. Nobody was hurt. Nobody ran. Nobody did anything foolishly. The only one that was kind of amusing was the individual that ran the restaurant in Walla Walla that I told you about. He was in California, I think, setting up grow operations down in California at the time. And he was staying at some guy's house in the L.A. area. And the feds tracked his cell phone to this house. They went to serve a warrant on him, take a cell phone and so forth, and arrest him. He came walking out of the back of the house. They were on one side of a pool in the backyard, and he was on the other side. And he saw him and took his phone and threw it in the pool. So he thought he would destroy the evidence because he did all of his business by texting.
Uh-huh.
And he decided that, you know, throwing it in the pool would protect him. What it did is added a little more jail time to a sentence because that's an additional crime.
Destroying
and
evidence.
Destruction of evidence. Yeah. And they recovered all the data from his phone anyway.
Wow.
So in the end, it you know, we could have done significantly better. And in my opinion, had we been allowed to go two hunting seasons instead of one, and had we been allowed to go a little bit longer, you know, finish out the 2 years we had been told, I think we would have done, you know, we were growing exponentially every month. We were, you know, the word was getting out, but we're trustworthy, we're good people, all this kind of stuff. And so we were getting more and more business every week. And I think it would have been, it turned out to be an outstanding operation in my opinion, but I think it would have been even far better had we been allowed to continue. But that too is irrelevant now. It is what it is, and we got what we got. So,
still, like you said, it was a huge success, and everything went smooth even after the bump in the road, which is outstanding to hear. That it sounds like was anybody tipped off? Did anybody? That's what I'm curious. Did anybody know they were coming? So they met him at the door and said, "Come on in," or were they?
You know, not that I can recall off the top of my head.
It's kind of hard to flush a deer down the toilet. So.
Yeah, it is. It really plugs them. But one of the individuals I told you we bought a lot of deer and elk from, that the first elk we bought from this guy was in his bathtub. So he'd killed an elk, put it in a garbage bag, and filled his bathtub full of ice to keep it cold until we could get there. So I've taken deer out of bathtubs before, but that was my first elk out of a bathtub.
Oh, my goodness.
So he at least had it close to the toilet if you wanted to try and flush the elk.
Yeah. I'm glad I said that now. And the guy that had the cockfights, I mean, that's when you bring that into it, I just think of pretty seedy people that do cockfighting. You know, that's certainly illegal. That's on the edge. And the type of people that are involved with that, yeah, they're just like you described. Their monkeys do the work. This I can picture that going into a Cambodian layout with people betting on. I mean, and this betting going on these cockfights, and I'm sure he's running that too. So there's some money involved. I mean, yeah, that sounded like a good grab. And in fact, I can get five or six elk. Oh my goodness! I mean, he had a pipeline.
The cockfight thing was funny because. But the first time we went into his backyard with him, he had all these little cages with chickens in them. And I'm like, hey, you raise chickens? No, I don't. Cocks. Okay, what's the deal? Oh, the cockfight. And I can't remember the dollar figure, but to get in the door on one of those things was like $500 or $1,000 or something. I mean, it was big money to get in the door, and he ran them. And so he invited us to one and said, you know, you guys can come with me as my guests. And we kicked it around a little bit, thought that might not be the best idea for us to go to the cockfight. So we saw it. I saw him do it in the backyard of his house one time, but we never went to one of the cockfights because we kind of thought we might stand out like a sore thumb.
Oh, I bet you would have. I bet you would have. Oh, that's a great operation. And you wrote the book about Operation Cody. So people that really want to get into it more, I read the reviews on Amazon, Todd. They're outstanding. You're putting out that information, and you're educating people around the country and around the world what is going on. I keep telling people that, you know, it's estimated we catch 1% of illegal wildlife activity, 1%, and that's just, it's insane that we're only catching 1%. And I'd like to think we could do better. Types of these operations certainly are effective, and you proved it within a year. You had all these incredible cases, you had all these connections. You know, who knows what 2 years would have brought, but you made a big dent in it.
Impressive. The book Operation Cody, it was funny because I had some people that were critical of me writing the book because they said, hey, you're profiting on a, you know, undercover case, you work for the state. And my first response was, if you think I'm profiting, you don't know anything about writing books.
It's kind of like podcasting.
But, yeah, I suppose. I wrote the book, obviously not to make money, because if I did so to make money, I failed. Mm. I wrote the book for two reasons. One, was I wanted the people in the state of Washington to realize what was going on in their own agency, and just to educate the people, you know, the outdoorsmen from Washington. And the second and more important reason I wrote the book was to educate people from other jurisdictions on what's going on. You had a long career in wildlife. How many wildlife trafficking cases for deer or elk meat have you made?
Right. Zero.
Okay. That's the answer from most people. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, prior to this operation, I think there have been one case and maybe two, but I think one case in Washington's history of trafficking in meat, deer and elk. When we started this, I didn't expect at all that we would be dealing in meat. I just thought, now there's no way. It's a market that doesn't really exist. It's not high enough dollar to get people interested. They're better off staying with eagles, raptors, bear gall bladder and claws and stuff like that. But I didn't expect the meat aspect, and it was enormous. So the reason that came up, or the reason I wanted to focus on the meat part in the book, is because I think an awful lot of jurisdictions across North America think what I did before the case. Both Officer Marstad and I both were of the opinion that was, if it was occurring, it was very, very rare. And we found out it is not at all rare. Restaurants were dealing in it. It wasn't just Chinese restaurants. We had other restaurants that were dealing in it. It was very commonplace. And so that was a really important reason for me to write that book, was to educate officers, game wardens from other jurisdictions that take a look at this possibility, that don't assume that because nobody's ever made a case on it, that it's not occurring. Most of the wildlife trafficking cases we dealt with, they had a fairly small circle. I mean, they weren't selling to 10 restaurants. They were selling to one or two, and they didn't expand much because it's stupid. Right. So there are cases that I was a uniform officer for a long time, and I'd like to think that I was a pretty good uniform officer, but I'd never made a trafficking case. And the reason is I'd made a lot of deer and elk cases. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of deer and elk cases, but you never even think to ask why. You never think to ask why a guy killed an elk close season, or why a guy's got three deer instead of the one he's legally allowed to have. It just didn't dawn on me as a uniform officer that this might be a commercial operation. It naive of me, I guess. But I think a lot of us are naive when it comes to that. So that was a...
And I think you hit it at the beginning of the podcast when you talked about your very first undercover case, because most of the uniform officers would have got that information that this guy had bear, mountain lions, bobcats in his freezer, the dogman there. And we would have taken that information, we would have wrote a search warrant, we'd executed the search warrant, we would have made a great case, but that's where it would have ended, right mm-hmm. there.
Exactly.
And we would have stopped one individual, not 10 individuals.
Yep.
And yeah.
Yep, and on top of that, having it on video, even without audio, is enormously helpful. I mean, you go to... The first step, of course, is your prosecutor in the jurisdiction that you're charging. It makes their job a hell of a lot easier if you can watch it on a video, exactly what the officer's describing, the money changing hands, you know, the whole thing. Secondly, on the vast majority of our contacts, probably 95% of our contacts, there was two of us there. So we had two officers. We had at least one camera, usually two, sometimes three. Cameras running all the time. So we had two of us and cameras backing up everything we said. It made, even if we were just getting a smaller case, you know, like you said, a guy that kills one elk close season or something like that, that kind of evidence, the video evidence and two officers, is pretty tough to defeat for a defense attorney. So we had a good system. It worked out really well. And I think I'm not trying to tell other jurisdictions how to run their business or to say that you definitely have this going on in your jurisdiction. I just want people to think about it. I just want officers to keep in the back of their mind, why is this guy a habitual poacher? I mean, how many deer or how many elk can you eat?
And certainly we've had other officers, the Operation North Shore in Ohio with Captain Ron Aulis was on, And he, you know, they had a huge search warrant execution based on the same stuff. A lot of deer meat that was being turned into snack sticks and then sold out of at a factory, and had all these connections. And he was killing deer mainly for the antlers, but he was turning all that meat into snack sticks and profiting on it. And then that just rolled into another case, into another case, into another, you know, like you said, it made that connection. It just kept getting bigger, 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 where they were executing search warrants statewide. So you are, I think you're right. I think we don't understand the larger aspect as game wardens. We don't think beyond that first case, and some of it is because we don't have the resources to go beyond that first case. Make a good case, and I'll tell you, the excitement, if you gave me all that information, I'd want to make that case. That it's hard for me to hand on something else, and let's kick this can down the road and see if we can get some bigger people when I've got a good case in my hand. So that's the struggle I would have.
You know, I mean, there's more than one way to skin a cat. So if a jurisdiction doesn't have undercover officers available, or doesn't have any at all, or your administration is opposed to it, the other option, of course, is when you catch that guy that's killed five deer in one season and you get him to admit that he's selling them to someplace, keeping that in mind and making that part of the interview of the guy. You get someone that says that I've sold deer, or I've sold elk, or I've sold bear gallbladder. You don't have to do an undercover. You can have that guy go back and do the sale for you, have a controlled sale or controlled buy. So it doesn't necessarily have to involve undercover officers. You can use the same person that's already in it to do it for you. The one thing I said at the beginning of Operation Cody, at the beginning of our discussion today, that we were asked to include sturgeon caviar. Mm. And I just thought, there is absolutely no way. This is, you know, out of all the groups of people that I've worked undercover, the most cautious were the Russians. They really are an untrusting group of people when it comes to non-Russians, you know, in organized crime. I'm not talking about in general. It wasn't too long into the operation, I'd say maybe 4 or 5 months into the operation, that we had a confidential secretary in the Olympia office who received a phone call, a poaching call from a Russian. And this Russian individual said that he had information about somebody that was unlawfully buying sturgeon caviar or sturgeon eggs. And so she called me and told me about it. I decided to call the guy myself, you know, not telling him I'm undercover and that kind of stuff. I just called him as an officer. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed this guy over the phone, the reporting party. And I'll never forget what he said. I mean, he had run into a guy. He was at a Russian store, an Eastern European store in the Seattle area, buying food. And he ran into this guy who was he was looking at caviar. The reporting party was looking at a can of caviar. And this guy saw him doing it and said, "Oh, you like caviar? Yes. Well, here, you can call me anytime you want it. You know, I only deal with Russians. And, you know, so call me and I'll get you a better price on caviar." I said, okay. So the guy ended up calling our office. I spoke to the guy. He only had a phone number. Didn't have a name. The guy had written down his phone number and said, "Call me if you want some caviar." And the guy warned me he'll only talk to Russians. I mean, he won't deal with anybody that's a Russian. Well, we don't have a Russian officer on our agency. Mm-hmm. And so I started calling all around. I called Seattle PD, I called King County, called the larger agencies looking for a Russian officer, a Russian speaking officer. I couldn't find one, but I talked to somebody with Seattle PD who was married to a federal agent with a federal agency that I won't mention. And she had a Russian informant working for her that was willing to do basically anything. Mm. And so we met with this informant, and he called the main suspect, Igor, and he had a conversation with him about caviar over the phone. Igor agreed to sell him caviar, but the guy said, "It's not for me, it's for a friend of mine, but he is an American, he doesn't speak Russian." And so Igor at that time said, "Well, I speak English also." So he just handed me the phone, and I spoken English to the guy. We set up a meeting, and I bought a very large amount of caviar over and over and over from him. The first purchase I made from him of sturgeon caviar, he gave me the caviar, and I said something about, is this white or green sturgeon? The two species that we have in Washington, and one you can fish for, one you can't. And he said, no, it's American sturgeon. Well, American sturgeon is a nickname for paddlefish. Mm-hmm. Paddlefish don't exist in Washington. Our statute in Washington says the definition of wildlife is anything that exists in the wild in Washington. We don't have paddlefish, so it's really not in our jurisdiction whatsoever. We don't have any authority over paddlefish. So the same federal agent that I told you about that I had spent the night with him after a bear gall case, the same guy, I called him and asked him, you know, if he was interested in this case. I got this guy that is selling me paddlefish caviar. And he goes, you know where it's from? And I said, yeah, Oklahoma. So he said, you know, he asked the guy's name, and I told him. And as I said, I'm kind of a smart aleck at times. I played practical jokes on people a lot. So I had a real difficulty convincing him that the name I was giving him was legitimate, because I told him the guy's name that I was working, and he said, no way. Who told you that? You know, you're not supposed to go around saying that. You know, and he was just drilling me about who in our agency told you this guy's name? And I told him, I said, hey, the guy was sitting in my truck. I bought caviar from him. Here it is. And he said, are you serious? And I said, yeah. And he said, we've been working that guy for quite a while with Oklahoma. Turns out Carlos, who you know well.
Yeah.
Carlos was the guy that had been working him on the Carlos Gomez with Oklahoma Fish and Wildlife, was the guy that had been working the case with the feds in Oklahoma. And they had actually tracked the vehicle from Oklahoma to Washington, to, you know, West Side, Puget Sound. But there was not a crime if they were not doing it for commercial purposes. If they weren't selling it, it's not illegal to take the roe out of paddlefish. It's just illegal to sell it. And so they couldn't make a case on selling it. They said, they knew that he was coming to Washington and distributing it to people, but they couldn't say for sure that money was exchanging hands. And as I said, it's kind of a hard group to break into.
Yeah.
So, you know, I told him, yeah, money exchanged hands. I got it on video. We got the guy. And that's how that ended up working out. It was a coordinated effort between U.S. Fish and Wildlife in Oklahoma, U.S. Fish and Wildlife in Washington, Oklahoma State, and Washington State all coordinated together. During Operation Cody, Carlos Gomez called me and said he had an individual that was selling whitetail antlers attached to the skull, which by Oklahoma law is illegal. And he said, can I ask you to see if you can make contact with the guy and if he'd be willing to sell to you? And I said, sure. So I did, and he did. And we made that case also, and Carlos was real happy about that one. So, you know, that goes back to what I said about the conferences where you meet investigators. Yes. I mean, it's really nice to be able to say, hey, I know this guy. I can talk to him. In my career, I did two officer exchanges. One was to New Zealand and one was to Oklahoma. I'm not trashing Oklahoma at all, but New Zealand's a hell of a lot better. So I worked with New Zealand officers for a couple of weeks, and I worked with the Oklahoma guys, I think, for a week. I had an absolute blast in Oklahoma, the nicest guys you've ever met. And Carlos was one of them. And so we ended up working together on Operation Cody on a couple of different cases, which was interesting. So,
yeah, no, which Carlos brought me to you as well, Todd. I certainly had heard about you prior to, but when we talked about Operation Cody during his podcast, I'm like, I got to reach out to Todd like right away. And that's what brought us. Carlos brought us together, which is really awesome to get this story out about Operation Cody to get people so they can buy the book, read the book. Very, very, very cool to get the more detailed information. Podcasts are one thing, but when you read a book, you get the whole enchilada.
Oh. Yeah. books brings up my next pitch, and that is since Operation Cody, have written six fiction books about game wardens. And the name of the series is Wildlife Justice Series, and where you can just get on Amazon and search my name. But the Wildlife Justice Series is a series of six books, all using the same base characters, the same base of game wardens, primarily the lead officer in it is a woman named Lisa Bennington. And they're similar in Operation Cody and as to my intent. If anybody reads one of the books, they'll see right away that part of what I do is to educate people on how game wardens work, how we go about putting a case together, how difficult they are to put a case together, the obstacles to putting a case together. And so each book, I kind of profile a different segment of our jobs, because I've always said that people, even hunters and fishermen, don't fully understand what we do.
At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
I think a lot of people think that we drive around the woods and we watch a guy shoot a deer and bring it out in the back of his truck and we arrest him. As you know, it's very rare to actually witness a violation like that. It's the vast majority of our success comes from information. And the only way to get information is to treat people with respect.
Yes.
And that leads me into another case that I had. It was my largest case I ever had as a uniform officer. I had 26 bull elk killed in Washington in a 2-year period. And these were enormous bulls. We had such a large number of bulls shot and wasted that they shut down the permit drawings for that entire unit because we lost so many bulls.
Wow.
The same thing was occurring in Oregon at the same time. So they were having the same thing. They were finding a lot of bulls that had been shot and the antlers were cut off and the body just sitting there rotting. So for 2 years, I was running around gathering shell casings, getting bullets out of the carcasses. I was making foot impressions of the footprint. I did tire impressions, plaster tire impressions. I had a ton of physical evidence. I mean, I had everything a person would need to put together a case that nobody could wiggle out of, except for the suspect. I had no idea who did it. We had fingerprints, but fingerprints didn't come back to anybody. So the one thing that I had was a somewhat vague description of the vehicle. It was, I think it was white, a white Ford pickup, and it had a bunch of stickers on the back window. And the driver was described to me as short, 5'4", 5'5", with a goatee. And that's all I had. And I went around finding these carcasses and having them turned into me. Finally, one day, a archery hunter had been up scouting for the upcoming archery season at the end of August. He was scouting the season open in September. And he got to a particular Forest Service gate, and the gate had been cut open, was open. And he thought that was kind of weird. And he kept hearing a chainsaw running inside that gate area. So he went in, explored, found the side road the guy was cutting firewood on, and he said, okay, I don't know why a guy would break a gate to come in and get firewood, but whatever. So he walked on past him, looked for elk. Hour later, when he walked back, the truck was gone. And what struck him was the wood that the guy had been cutting was just rolled off into the ditch. He didn't take it. Well, why would a guy cut it and not take it? So he thought, oh, he wasn't cutting firewood. He was cutting a log out of the way of the road. And he went up the road further, and here's this enormous elk dead with the antlers missing. So he had just missed the guy. So he described the vehicle to me. Then later, another citizen had run into the same vehicle in an area where he backtracked the guy's tracks to another carcass. So that's all I had, is a description of the person and description of the vehicle. And for 2 years, I tried to find him. I mean, I put up cameras. I had volunteers to sit on roads looking for the guy or the vehicle. Nothing. I came up with absolutely nothing. the case came together because I went down to the Snake River and was checking fishermen. And in Washington, if you're fishing for steelhead, you had to pinch your barbs down, have a barbless hook. And so I went down. There was only one guy in this one particular spot fishing. And I asked him to reel his gear in. And he asked me, why was I going to check his hook? And I said, yep. And he goes, it's barbed. And I said, well, okay, you know, it's illegal to have it barbed. And he said, yeah, I just figured I'd do it till I got caught. And I said, well, why? And he said, well, I think it's a bullshit law. And I just told myself I was going to do it till I got caught. I guess I'm caught. So I got his information. I went up to my truck. I ran him. He was a convicted felon, had quite a criminal history. And I went back, gave him his fishing license and said, don't do it again. See you later. He followed me up to my truck. And at the truck, he said, I don't get it. How come I'm not getting a ticket? And I said, well, the main reason is almost everybody lies to me on every contact. And you told me the truth. I mean, from the start, you told me the truth.
Yes.
So I said, if I run into you again and you have a barbed hook, you get paper. But on this, you know, I appreciate honesty and I'm going to reward it. So he asked me if I had a business card and I gave him a business card. He told me he was going to call me. A couple of days later, he did. And he said, do you want to know who's killing all the elk in the Blue Mountains? And I said, I'd love to know. Absolutely. So he gave me the name of a guy who was a mortgage banker and said, he's got one of the elk. I don't think he pulled the trigger on it, but he's got one of them in his garage. And I said, okay. So we got that elk from that individual. And one of the few times in my life I told somebody to get a lawyer, we arrested that guy for the elk that he had in possession. And I said, call a lawyer, have your lawyer call me, and we'll sit down and talk. So, and that's how it rolled into a much larger case because people started to roll on each other as if you'd had a million times. Had I given that guy a ticket for a barbed hook, I wouldn't have made, I don't know if I ever would have made the case, but I sure wouldn't have made it then. Right. And so I've told a lot of our newer officers about that and said, you know, that when you get into an area, especially if it's a small county or small town, like the county I was in was probably 2,500 people, 2,800 people in the entire county. And I said, if you treat people with respect, whether they're bad guys or good guys, if you just treat them with respect and honesty and treat them like you would want to be treated if you were in their shoes, you will find it pays tenfold. Well, it's a lot, for one thing. It's a lot harder to get really angry or hostile with somebody that you like. Obviously, it happens. I mean, domestic violence, but it's harder to, you know, resist an officer or lie to them or anything like that if you had a good relationship with them in the past. And so that's how that case came together. I didn't have any history with the guy, but I treated him fairly. I mean, one of the first things he said to me when he came up to my truck is, no cop has ever given me a break. What's this about? What are you doing? he just couldn't understand why he wasn't getting a ticket.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's that story.
Yeah. And that's a great story for sure. It's the smallest things that break the biggest cases. And what a great example of that, going from a barb hook that wasn't pinched to being able to solve your biggest case and devastating a population. And that's what we talk about that a lot, that wildlife isn't like your normal stuff. You kill something like that and it affects the whole herd. It affects it for the time frame. You know, you kill a doe, you're talking, she's probably got, you know, she probably has twins or potential to have twin fawns in the spring. So there's three deer potentially you killed illegal. So it rotates and it takes the wildlife time to replenish their numbers. So poaching has a huge impact.
Absolutely.
And cases like we've talked about today, Todd, have a huge impact too. So thank you for your service. Thank you for your service to the resources of Washington State. Thank you for what you did, because those had far reaching. We talk about reaching out to Oklahoma, meeting, you know, Carlos down there with the paddlefish. Definitely had far reaching things. Chicago with the gallbladders, making all those connections. That was a great case, definitely. And everybody should pick up the book Operation Cody by Todd Vandervoort, Washington State Game Warden. Hey, I tell everybody this is your podcast as much as my podcast. It's a Game Warden podcast. So anything in conclusion?
Oh, no. You had sent me an outline of potential questions, and one of them was, I don't remember how you titled it, but like humorous wildlife stories. And
yeah.
So I called a guy last night to confirm that I've got the story right. And I confirmed it. So 20 years ago, probably, I was in Dayton in that small county, and somebody had shot a poached sow bear and left a cub. The cub went up a tree and wouldn't come down. And somebody heard the shot, found the dead sow, saw this cub up a tree. So I was called there. I don't remember if I darted the cub. I assume I did. I darted the cub, put him in a, the only thing I had to transport a bear cub in was my dog's kennel, porta kennel. By the way, my dog wasn't too happy about that afterwards, but I had this cub that was probably 25, 30 pounds, you know. I put him in the dog kennel, and the people that had reported it had already called all over the state of Washington trying to find a rehab center that would take a bear cub. And, you know, they're not real popular. So he had difficulty finding somebody, except he found one on the west side of the state. I was on the far east side of the state. So he told me, I found this rehabilitation place that'll take it. And, you know, if you can get it over there, they're willing to raise it. So I'm like, great. So I was building an airplane at the time in my garage. And I needed to get some parts. And the parts were in Oregon, Portland area, Troutdale. And so I had planned on making a trip over there anyway. Well, in order to get to Troutdale, Oregon, from where I was going, I had to go right by, probably half an hour away on the highway, half an hour away from Shelton, Washington, which is one of the areas I was stationed before. And that was close to where the wildlife rehabilitator was. So my plan was to meet up with one of our officers in Shelton, Matt Nixon, transfer the bear cub to him. He could take to the rehabber. So I take the bear and my dog's kennel. I put in a bowl of dog food and some water, put in the back of my truck. I have a canopy on my truck. I throw it in the truck. I'm ready to go. And as one of our other officers, this is in my personal private truck. It's obvious I'm not going to get airplane parts in my work truck. Mm-hmm. So I've got this bear cub in the back of my truck. One of my neighboring officers called and said, hey, he's going to go buy a truck that was right up on the Canadian border, which is a long ways out of my way. But he said, hey, can you take me over to Seattle? One of our other guys could pick me up in Seattle. He's going to drive me up to the border. Sure. So I've got this officer off duty, me off duty, and a bear cub in the back of their truck. We drive over to the Seattle area. He calls the officer that's supposed to give him a ride. The officer says, hey, I can't do it. I got called on something else. So my friend, you know, Mike, looks over at me and says, hey, can you drive me up to Blaine, which is on the border of US and Canada? I'm like, well, that's not really on my way. And he said, well, I'd really appreciate it. I don't know how else I'm going to get home. I'm buying this pickup truck. So I said, all right, good. So I drive up to Blaine with him. We pull up to the customs building. They have the duty-free store and all that. I'm parked in the parking lot. And this guy is supposed to bring the car or the truck that he's buying down so he can look at it. And I open the back of the canopy to check on this little bear cup. And I open the canopy, I drop the tailgate, and I put my face down to look in the cage. And I say, are you okay? And he reaches down with one of his paws, gets a big pile of his feces, and throws it through the screen on the front of the dog cage, and it goes in my mouth. So I wasn't real happy. And so I backed up and spitting out bear poop out of my mouth. And it's all over my shirt. And so I leaned in and I yelled at him and I said, you know, something, you pissed me off or something like that. And he did it a second time. He threw it in my face the second time. So I opted not to shoot him in the parking lot of the customs office. So I closed the canopy. Mike got his truck and I turned around to drive south to get airplane parts. By now I realize I'm too late. By the time I get to Portland, it's going to be too late. So I'm going to have to get a motel someplace. So I call Matt Nixon, one of our officers. He was a sergeant with us. And I said, hey, I'm still coming. I'm running really late, but I'm still coming. I still have this bear cub. And he goes, great. So by then, I'm not a real fan of this bear cub. Each time I'm making it. So we get down to Shelton, meet him at the office. I reach in, put him on a catch pole, and pull him out of the truck, and we're going to transfer him to the cage in the back of Matt's truck so he can take him in the rehabber. And as soon as he hits the ground, he runs over and bites Matt on the ankle and bit right through his boot. So he through all that, he still came out okay, and he was rehabbed and lived happily ever after, I guess. But that was one of the more entertaining dealing with wildlife that I ever had.
Oh, yeah, I've never had that. I put a bear cub and a dog have a heart once to transport them, and then I tried to carry it across the field to let it loose on the other side. And, yeah, you can't do that. He was pretty active, banging back and forth to the point where, you know, I'd set it down, I'd walk a foot or two, and it would vibrate out of my hands. So I let him go in the middle of the field, basically, and he ran off. But, bear cubs are, I never had one throw poop at me. I'm pretty happy about that. But I wish I had heard that as a younger officer. That way I wouldn't have put myself in that position. Because I'm like, how many times did I look in a crate that I had a bear cub or something? So,
Just being me, I didn't tell any of our officers about that. for two reasons. One, because I was an idiot for doing that. And secondly, I felt maybe they'll learn someday.
Oh, too funny. Oh, that's great. Well, thanks for sharing that, Todd, and thanks for sharing all your stories. And thanks for writing the books, too. The more game warden stories are out there, the more we educate the people what we do. And by every state, we do something a little different, you know. New Hampshire Fish and Game is pretty heavy into search and rescue. We have the White Mountains. We have a lot of hikers. We do a lot of search and rescue missions comparatively to others that don't have that responsibility or have it on a lighter basis. So it's very interesting to see how the other parts of the country operate, and as well as just getting connected and finding how much we have in common too.
Yeah,
thanks again.
Absolutely.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other game wardens on our adventures protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders.
Join Captain Justin Leake and Meredith McCord for the best fishing action along Panama City Beach. Tune in to Chasing the Sun every Sunday at 9:30 a.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.
When you go out there and the fish are where you think they are, any one of these casts could be the bite. It's the most exciting fishing that I know right here at Hawks Cay.
Oh, that's awesome.
Experience the best saltwater fishing the world has to offer. Don't miss Thursdays with Saltwater Experience. Brought to you by Golden Boat Lifts. Every Thursday night from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV. The destination for outdoor entertainment.